The following talk was given at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on August 3, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Morning. Good to see all of you today. So I've been exploring a new text. I thought today I would sort of give a short talk here, kind of projecting this upcoming course that I'll be doing in September. And so the course is based on The Roots of Goodness, a book by Tom Wright, where there's like a translation of Uchiyama's commentary on this gets complicated, on Dogen's 95th fascicle, okay? And the title of that fascicle is the eight understandings of a great person, okay? So it's like commentary on commentary on commentary. And so, I'll kind of explain a little bit about, the first of the eight, understandings of a great person. Okay. And I found this teaching to be very helpful. And as I'm going through this text, it's just interesting to see how different people translate things and how their teachings are slightly different in some ways to bring out the same teachings. And so often I found myself going back, I would get confused a little bit in what was being presented by Uchiyama or Tom Wright, and I would go back to the original fascicle by Dogen, and it was actually quite clear from the beginning. And so, you know, probably my own fault. I get confused easily. But I just want to say up front that the course that I'll be doing in September, oftentimes I will be just going back to the original, you know, translation of Dogen to bring out those teachings and leaving kind of the commentary off to the side. Although I do find some of the commentaries very helpful. So just to give you kind of a back context of that course. So the first of the eight understandings of a great person, is not wildly chasing after the objects of one's desires of the five senses that have not yet been fulfilled is what is called having few desires. A person with many longings or cravings suffers proportionally greater. One whose heart acts with few desires is always at peace and has few anxieties or misgivings. In a word, one with few desires is virtually in nirvana. This is what is called having few desires. Sorry for my voice. I went to Valley Fair yesterday with my daughter and niece, her, you know, my nieces and nephews. And so apparently it, you know, impacted my voice in some way.
Maybe it's
smoke. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't the best day to be outside. We had like the second worst air, whatever in the world, apparently, or something like that. United States, I'm confused. What's that? Yeah, that could have been it. Well, and it was my daughter's first time to, she's four, right? And so it was her first time at Valley Fair. And so it was just the joy to be with her, and I was screaming to her while she was screaming on his rides. So yeah, definitely a lot of yelling going on with the not so good air. So a combination of all the things. Anyhow, so back to the, so basically what we're talking about here is desire, right? And so what I think is interesting about this teaching is that when we hear something like desire, right, where our mind goes, and our mind goes to, well, having too much desire isn't a good thing, you know. So we want to kind of squash the desire, right? And so that's our usual approach, is we find the problem, you know, and then we want to deal with the problem as we first diagnosed it, okay? And what's helpful about these teachings is that it's not going quite where we would suspect they would go, okay? So grasping the sense objects, okay, is a delusion. And Steve Hagen talked about this the last talk that he gave here on Sunday, where he was talking about sentient beings. And that's basically what a sentient being is that we grasp at these sense objects, and there's like this external world, you know, and these external things are objects of mind that we pursue and go after, that they are going to somehow satisfy, you know, what we're looking for. They're going to satisfy our deep ache of the heart, as it's called here. And so of note here, though, in the way that it's worded here in this translation by Dogen, is desires of the five senses that have not yet been fulfilled. Okay. So we're going to oscillate a little bit here between the relative and the absolute, or like the kind of superficial understanding of these teachings and the more in-depth. Okay. So we have the ability to conceptualize and project our experiences. Okay. So we get deceived by consciousness, basically. We project. We can forecast in the future. And we often, we navigate life this way, as we have these projections. You know, we think we can, forecast what's going to happen next in our life. And this happens at micro and macro levels. So in a little bit, I'll bring out the macro more. But basically we're deceived, by consciousness, the objects of mind. We really truly believe them to be ultimately, true and real. And then, you know, we forecast, we project, and we take actions based on all of this thinking, you know, all of this mental projecting. Okay. And that's where most of us live out our life, is just in this area of delusion, you know, thinking things are ultimately true and real. When in fact, it's just, we're confused from the very beginning. So we hear this and we might think, so I'm supposed to get rid of my desires, as I was alluding to it at the beginning. Our common diagnosis is that we have desires. Clearly, if we've lived long enough, we can see that our desires and chasing after our desires can get us into trouble. You know, it doesn't ultimately yield the fruit that we're hoping. And so, it's not it. It's not that we need to get rid of our desires, when actually our desires are pretty helpful. You know, we have a desire to eat. Well, if we don't eat, we know what's going to happen, right? So it isn't that our desires are all bad, and it isn't that we have to entirely dismiss or get rid of desires. And in fact, the desire to get rid of desires is another desire, right? So we just get caught in this, like this game, you know, of it's all thinking, it's all thought produced. So the problem actually is that we're confused. We chase illusory phantoms, our mental projections, and get caught in the trap of thinking that life will finally be okay once I get that next thing. Okay. And this is our usual approach. This is our usual diagnosis. It's like, I would be happy if only, you know, the if onlys, keeping up with the Joneses, you know, if only I had the right job, the right partner, all this, the degree, you know, all of this stuff, is what we think we need in order to achieve that grand state of happiness. So this is where our common diagnosis goes wrong. What is the actual issue here? Again, we might think it's our desires. We might think that we have to eradicate desires somehow. When in fact, the actual issue is that we're confused about the fundamental nature of reality. Okay. And when I first started encountering these teachings, I just thought, whoa, you're taking, I just want to be a little bit happier. And then all of a sudden we're going way off the deep end of the pool, you know, with, now it's about the fundamental nature of reality, right? Where I just wanted to be happy, you know? So we just kind of go off the deep end fairly quickly here. However, this is part of the problem, is that we do not diagnose the problem. We're not understanding even what the problem actually is. Okay. We often just think that the problem is that I don't have the right job, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So even in our diagnosis, we're off the mark. So it's that we're ignorant about the true nature of reality. And this word ignorance is not pejorative. It's not saying that this is bad. It's almost like we don't know. We just don't know yet. And it's almost like I mentioned, I have a 4-year-old daughter. It's like when she does something that's like off the mark, right? Where when she's just desiring something and throwing a temper tantrum, there's no malicious feelings there. It's kind of like she just is confused, right? She just wants what she wants. She doesn't know any better about what eating 50 candy bars in a day is going to do, you know? So I have to step in and kind of quell, you know, do the best I can to deal with that. So in short, we're simply confused about this moment. And this is a quote from Steve Hagen's book, Buddhism Plain and Simple. But it's profound. This part is actually very profound. And this is in the back section of Dependent Arising, which is sort of like an appendices of the book, which are actually very profound in Buddhism Plain and Simple. So in short, we're simply confused about this moment. As Wang Po said, in our ignorance, we reject actual experience in favor of what we think. Thus, we posit a self in our thought, and we see permanence where there actually isn't any. And so this desire is coming from a place of, I'm something that persists through time. I'm something that exists, and because of that, I need to take things or get things in order to appease my desires. And so this whole thing is based on a confusion about existence, that I exist. Now our mind might immediately go towards, well, sir, you're saying that you don't exist. That's not what's being pointed out here either. So nothing actually arises, persists, or dies as a separate entity. This is what we can actually know, but we ignore it. But it certainly looks that way. It certainly looks like things arise, you know, persist for a while, and then dies, goes out of existence. This is the way that it looks. And so we don't negate this. We don't negate the appearances. It certainly appears that way. But our difficulty here is that we're taken in by that. We're taken in by the objects of mind. We're taken in by the appearances. So we truly believe that our whole setup, our thinking, the way that we frame our experience, and we frame, when I say frame, like it's more subtle than that. It's like baked into the cake of our thinking, right? So we firmly just believe that the world is the way that we think it is. And I don't mean the individual thoughts that we might have about reality. I mean that I exist or separate things exist. Like this whole framework is off from the very beginning. And so there are two kinds of ignorance. As Steve presents it in Buddhism Plain and Simple. There's blindness. This is where we're ignorant of the basic realities of existence. That everything is impermanence, dukkha, and selflessness. So we're ignorant of this. So we're ignorant of the basic fundamental realities of existence. And then there's self-deception. And self-deception is our belief that we can intellectually know what things are. An example, in the book, he provides water. Water is just hydrogen and oxygen. And then we miss the actual experience. That's a little bit, like, I don't think about water that way. I just think water. And so I'm just going to dumb this down a little bit for somebody like me. Like a chair. We think a chair, exists. And we think that we know what a chair is. I'll say, well, a chair is just the plastic and the metal that makes up that chair. And then I'll go off. You know, I know what the chair is, so I don't even have to think about it anymore. I just move on, and that's a solid object in my thinking. You know, like this whole framework, we're off from the very beginning. But we don't realize that. We don't realize that our setup is off from the very beginning. We're deceived by the nature of consciousness and what this is. We're deceived by the appearances. So we live in a, I've been waiting to bring this up. What I'm gonna bring up next. I'm pretty excited to present this to you guys. I don't know why. I've had this in the back of my mind for like a year now. But we live in a society that reinforces and capitalizes on this delusion of self and other and the desire to want more than we actually need. This is a problem in our society, right? We get sold this idea that we need to have more. We need to have more in order to be happy. So in 1927, a banker, Paul Mazur, was quoted in Harvard Business Review as saying, "We must shift from a needs to a desires, culture. People must be trained to desire, to want new things even before the old have been entirely consumed. We must shape a new mentality in America. Man's desires must overshadow his needs." Isn't that interesting? You know, because it's like, why do we live in this consumer-based society? Where did this come from? You know, and then, so I don't know if Paul Mazur was the originator of this, but he certainly wrote something that sounds like it, and that was back in 1927. So the purpose of this manufactured desire was to stimulate continuous economic growth by turning people into perpetual consumers. And then so let's just assume maybe he was or was not the originator of this, turning to a wants-based society, right? Then you get Edward Bernays, who is the nephew of Sigmund Freud, famous psychologist, right? And so Edward Bernays comes along and he implemented Mazur's strategy by using psychological manipulation through public relations and advertising. Very, I mean, this is like genius. This is like ingenious, you know, genius or ingenious. So he believed that stimulation of primal drives like hunger, sex, fear, and desire to make people want things they didn't actually need. And so here you have this idea to turn our society into like a wants-based, you know, economy, or society. And then you have Edward Bernays coming along and realizing that, hey, if you just sell these products in this way, you'll hook people. You'll hook people in and get them to believe that they need things that they don't actually need. So what we actually want aren't things that we need, you know? It's just crazy how much we live out of this. And I'm not pointing fingers. Like I'm certainly guilty of this as well. But how many things, if you look around your house or something, like how many random things do you just have laying around that you haven't used in like a year or 2 years that are just useless things that you have, you know? And so this is kind of where that comes from. So we have a society that fuels this, the separation between I and other, and ca really capitalizing on our desires. So we're trained from a young age to be hungry ghosts. And a hungry ghost, just to remind you, is like a being with a huge belly and a tiny throat. So the idea is that no matter how much a hungry ghost consumes, they're never going to quench their hunger because they're always going to perpetually be hungry, you know? And that's like us living in this society of just perpetually being sold this idea that we need more in order to be happy, in order to keep up with the Joneses. So we want love, we want attention, we want status, we want money. We want peace and we want that elusive thing of enlightenment, you know. Whatever it is, we think when I get that, I'll be fine. My life will be good when, if only. So it seems that our desire is more pernicious than other animals. So if we look, to other animals, like it doesn't seem that there's that same type of, you know, being desirous. Is that a word? Being desirous as we are. So in his book, Indemnification for Peace, Yonosuke Nagai writes, Most people are likely to think that a lion will kill and devour all prey that it sees. However, this does not appear to be true. In Africa, it is said that when a zebra or giraffe concludes that the nearby lion has eaten and is full, it will forage and eat or play without any fear whatever. It shows that animals' intuition or sense of danger is very astute. And if it decides that the lion is on the hunt, it will flee in a hurry. In other words, if the lion is hungry, it will go out on a hunt, but if it is full from eating, it will refrain from going out on a kill. However, this does not seem to be to hold for that animal called Homo sapiens, the animal with supposedly advanced powers of intellect. So the idea here is that if the lion, the lion only hunts when it's hungry, it doesn't take more than it needs. So once it's satisfied its hunger, its appetite, the other animals that it usually preys on feel free to play and wander, and they're not afraid, right? So they have these very astute senses of fear and danger. So not only does the lion not take more than it needs in terms of food, you know, and sustenance, but it's also true of shelter, you know? And I don't know why this image just was really striking to me. So I was thinking, you don't see lions going out trying to get the biggest mansion in the wild, right? They're not deceived by this. And I just think how ridiculous, I'm sorry, I don't mean to put anybody down, how ridiculous it is that we have mansions, you know, and like these way, way more than we would ever need, you know? I don't want to get off on, you know, I won't even go there. The idea of billionaires is an issue for me. You know, it's like, why do we need that much money? We have, you know, why would you ever need that much? We're so confused. So it's also true for animals that a lion is not gonna get more shelter than it actually needs. And this idea of ownership, doesn't seem to, you know, creep into a lion's thinking. Like, hey, I just have to protect myself from everything and project in the future and act based on this. So lions don't seem to live out of a leaning mind like we do. So when we think of something, say an idea or an emotion or desire or some image or conception, maybe a plan, all of this is just mental fabrication. For example, imagine some desire that we conceive. We're not particularly hungry, but the idea is if I don't eat something now, I'll be hungry later. And I don't know about you guys, but that was striking to me. I've been for quite a long time. I like wake up and I'll eat breakfast, not because I'm hungry. Most of the time, I wake up and eat breakfast because it's the most important meal of the day, you know. And so I've just been, and how much I live out of this, like I hear things that seem to be make sense. It's the most important meal of the day, because then after that you're gonna burn energy, you're burning off your breakfast. So I take action based on that I have to eat now because I might be hungry in the future. And I do this all the time, like daily, you know. And just how much we get deceived. So we don't act out of immediacy. We don't act out of what our immediate needs are. We project and we act out of what we think instead of what's actually now. And we're very much deceived by this. So we really are quite crazy. We act from these illusions, these mental fabrications, and we treat these as reality. And again, this confusion is basically built into the fabric of our society. Normally, as one type of sentient being, human beings, for some reason or other, are constantly looking to be satisfied. The reaction to this thought that seeks to be satisfied is suffering. Therefore, the more thoughts that we have that seek to be fulfilled or satisfied, the greater will be our suffering. So we become firmly convinced that such a thought of wanting to be satisfied is who we are. Okay. And so we're deceived about that idea of me and who I am. But we think as soon as I desire something or I need something, we It's a want, but we're selling it to ourselves as a need. It reinforces this delusion of self. And so we're drug around by self-deluded desires. And in many ways, we're still children chasing shiny things. I remember I was at a halfway house up in Duluth, Minnesota. And I remember there was a guy who was one of my housemates. And we were having a conversation about something. I think I was either talking about dating or like getting a car or something like, I don't remember the content of the conversation, but it was based on what I wanted, right? And he made this statement. He's like, oh, so you're just like a child just chasing after these shiny objects, you know? And for whatever reason, when he said that, it struck me like, yeah, I kind of am. I'm just like, I want the lollipop, you know, I want that shiny thing out there. And that's just what my life is based off of, just chasing the shiny objects, you know? For whatever reason, that just really resonated with me. All right. So wrapping it up here today. So one of the premises of this class that I'll be teaching is, becoming a great person or a true adult. Okay. And I'll be starting that course in September. So I'm going to just name for you the 8 qualities of a great person that Dogen highlights in this fascicle. So there's one is having few desires, knowing one has enough, appreciating serenity and quietude, making diligent effort, not losing sight of true dharma, concentrating on settling in samadhi, practicing wisdom, and not engaging in useless argument. And so those are the 8. And so he's going to sort of share with us the 8 qualities of how to become a dainin, a true adult. Okay. In closing today, it's a quote by Bai Zhang, profound quote here. So Zen Master Bai Zhang, Wang Po's teacher, said, if you realize there is no connection between your senses and the external world, you will be liberated on the spot. You would become a dainin or a true adult. I'll stop there. Questions or comments? By the way, we have an issue here with, we don't only have one microphone, so the Doan will probably have to back and forth. Or no, I forgot. I'm just going to summarize your question.
Oh,
yeah, that I forgot, sir. Okay.
What
was the fifth one? Not losing sight of true dharma. Yeah. Are you talking about the seventh quality of a great person is practicing wisdom? Yeah. I'm not going to say anything about that now, because you'll have to come to the class and learn more about that. Yeah. Actually, I did find these very helpful, these 8 qualities of a great person. And it was also the Buddha's last something. I don't want to say last talk or last, teaching that he gave, which is interesting because it was also Dogen's last teaching. It was the last fascicle in the Shobo Genzo. And so there was something to these 8 qualities that resonated with both Buddha and Dogen. Both of them viewed them as being particularly important, you know, and it gives us sort of a guide. You know? So please come to the class and we'll talk about it.
Yeah. Thank you.
If we're just really used to seeing things like our desire for this truth, can seeing them as illusions that could be disorienting or kind of throw us off a little bit?
Yeah, well, it depends. If we misunderstand what that's pointing to, perhaps, you know. Oh, I'm sorry. So if we ever took the idea of desires being illusions, would that be disorienting? I forgot who asked the question. Yeah. So So if we ever, was that right?
Is evidence seeing your desire and living your desire for evolution can add at least one.
Yeah, I hope everybody heard that. So again, yeah, it potentially, but if it's disorienting, there's a misunderstanding there. It does take a while. I want to say time is not really an issue here, but it's there can be a misunderstanding. It takes a while to see what these teachings are actually pointing to when we say desires are illusory, right? It doesn't actually mean that desires are illusory, you know. So basically what that's pointing to is that we take desires, we take everything actually as being ultimately true and real. Okay. That doesn't mean that they don't exist necessarily, right? We still have to eat food. We still have to live our life. And so it's just, it could be disorienting if we're misunderstanding what these teachings are pointing to. I don't know how to say it better than that. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm just sort of thinking we're all out of our time to some degree. So
yeah.
The quote you know is kind of left in front of us. The comment, the quote you meant for the guy who said you have to go from a consumer of needs kind of society, what we want society from 1927, and it's a couple of years later, there's this new stock market crash and this global depression. And my guess is the world became much more focused on needs. It's like, so, you know, I just had this feeling he was that statement, while it's sort of timeless because we do want stuff, it was also maybe locked into his own particular moment where the world was. Everything was great, and you know, everyone had stuff they wanted, and
yeah.
It was more hopes and getting global wars.
Yeah, likely, and I didn't put it in the time context like you brought out. Yeah, it's very true. So if societal, you know, issues happen, I got to repeat what you said. So basically that quote from Paul Mazur was from 1927, okay, where at the time he was probably living a good life and things were going well for him, and he could think about living out of our wants versus our desire, our needs, okay. And then the stock market crashed, the Great Depression happened. So as a result of that, people sort of had a tendency to have to live out of their needs. You know, they became more immediate. Okay. And then, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's a product of, you know, what's happening at society at large, you know? And so we're definitely a product. We're impacted by that, you know, and that influences the way that we think about things. I don't know when Edward Bernays came along. I'm assuming after that, at some point, maybe after the Great Depression, maybe once things got the economy got booming again or something like that, then this was implemented or something like that. But yeah, it definitely had an impact on all of us. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say one book that I read 60s that it's kind of and as I can see it, it's called Hidden Persuaders. Like Hidden Persuaders.
Hidden Persuaders?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's also worth noting that even in the 30s, Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda minister, was a big fan of American advertising, and he studied to compare and perfect his own taking some propaganda.
Yeah. I find that stuff very fascinating. You know, I think it's interesting. Like how did we get here? You know, like how do we come to think this way and really, really live out of our wants instead of our needs? Man, this is an issue, you know, very pervasive. And it's always struck me. I'm a social worker, as I've stated here before. Ever since I was young, I've always been so like interested in helping the less fortunate. So it's just always struck me that like, how are there poor people that don't have anything to eat, yet there's people that have billions of dollars? It doesn't make sense. It's never made sense to me. And I don't mean to get into politics or, you know, viewpoints or anything like that. Just at a fundamental childlike view. It's like, how does that even happen? It's crazy. It's crazy to me, you know? Anyway, thank you for that. Yeah.
You have said that writing about this topic was the last writings of Buddha and the last writings of Dogen before they died. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's incredibly profound, right?
Yeah.
This is what they wanted to say on the deathbed, and that's it. And that to me is like, right?
Yeah.
That's it. That's what these guys want to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. So what Kristen said is this was the last writings by the Buddha and Dogen. So obviously that means something. They viewed these teachings as being helpful. Yeah. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.